This report says, and that's what the Taliban have confirmed, Mullah Omar was living safely for almost 13, 14 years.
India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan continue to deal with terrorism and a ghost of its past. It's Tuesday, March 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, meditation to ease Rohingya minds. A movie tells war survivor stories. Endangered species in the crosshairs. Fighting the HPV virus. Eavesdropping on birds. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with India's Foreign Secretary in Washington Monday and told him that the United States stands with India in fighting terrorism. After their meeting, the State Department said the two discussed the importance of bringing to justice those responsible for a suicide attack on an Indian paramilitary convoy claimed by Pakistan-based militants. The State Department said the diplomats spoke of the urgency of Pakistan taking meaningful action against terrorist groups operating on its soil. Last month, a suicide bomber killed 40 Indian paramilitary troops in a convoy in the disputed Kashmir region. A Pakistan-based militant group claimed responsibility for that violence. New Delhi has vowed to punish Islamabad for sheltering the militants, saying the Indian Army chief has been given a free hand to take whatever action is required. Pakistan rejects Indian charges of playing a role in the February attack and maintains the militant group has long been outlawed as a part of counter-extremism measures. Meanwhile, a frankly bizarre story comes today from Afghanistan. Officials there are strongly rejecting a new American investigative report that claims the founder of the Taliban, Mullah Muhammad Omar, spent his final years in Afghanistan, not in neighboring Pakistan. Washington and Afghan officials have long asserted that Omar took refuge in Pakistan after a U.S.-led military coalition dislodged the Taliban from power. The New York-based Zamia Center says that's wrong, but Afghans are calling the report delusional. VOA's Ayaz Ghul has been following the claims. He spoke with our Doug Bernard.
Well, you know, this is the first time that someone has gone and investigated exactly what was the fate of Mullah Omar, you know, the founding leader of the Taliban. Because after the 9/11 invasion of Afghanistan led by the United States, the Taliban was toppled from, you know, they were dismissed from power in Kabul, and these Taliban, they just melted away in the population, and then they started insurgency. But the predominant view was that Mullah Omar fled to Pakistan, took refuge there, and that's when the operation began in search of all the Taliban leaders inside Afghanistan and with the help of Pakistani security forces on this side of the border.
So for a long time, I guess it's been the accepted wisdom that Mullah Omar fled into Pakistan and, you know, really lived out the remainder of his days there. But now comes a new report that says, no, not only did he not flee to Pakistan, he never actually set foot in the country.
That's true, and that raises a lot of questions now about the almost now 18-year-old war in Afghanistan against terrorism and against the Taliban. And that's what this report is also asking now, questions that there were so many claims made about this invasion and how they were, you know, the American and allied forces were gaining victories against the Taliban, if the top leader of this group was just living and hiding in a place which was just a few miles away from a major American military base in the southern Zabul province. And that's where this report says, and that's what the Taliban have confirmed, Mullah Omar was living safely for almost 13, 14 years.
Is this the reason why the official response from the government of Afghanistan seems to be as touchy as it is, or is there something else going on here?
No, it is quite an embarrassing situation for the Afghan government, because they are the ones who announced in 2015, in the July of 2015, that According to credible information, as they put it, Mullah Omar was under treatment in a hospital in Pakistani city of Karachi, and that after prolonged illness, he died in that hospital. So that was a big announcement, and that announcement was made out of the presidential office at a time when the United States was trying to bring the Taliban to the table for talks so that, you know, they could bring an end to this ongoing war. But this announcement by the Afghan government sort of derailed that effort of initiating peace talks with the Taliban. And since then, there has nobody has questioned, no journalist, no you know, research group questioned this narrative that was supported sort of by the Americans that Mullah Omar was actually in Pakistan and that he died in a hospital. So this is the first time that someone has actually put together a report. And as you know, this group, Zalma Center, you know, it is affiliated with New America Foundation, and it's not an ordinary coalition of think tanks that have put together this report that no, whatever the narrative was in place for years was not true.
VOA's Ayaz Gul speaking from Islamabad with VOA Asia's Doug Bernard. The Zomia Center report comes at a time when the United States is engaged in extensive peace talks with the Taliban in Qatar to seek a negotiated settlement to the Afghan war. Omar's close associate and co-founder of the Taliban, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, is supervising a team of insurgent leaders holding talks with American officials. The dialogue has been continuing for the past 2 weeks in Doha, but both sides are tight-lipped about the discussions. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. The United States says no phased approach to North Korea denuclearization. China and Vietnam regularly clashing at sea despite diplomacy. Woman suspected in assassination of Kim Jong-nam released. China's Mobike shutting some international operations. Exhibition looks into shadowy world of Australian espionage. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more with photos and video on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Approximately 1 million Rohingya refugees live in Cox's Bazar camp in Bangladesh, and according to the United Nations, the majority of them are women and girls. Most have severe traumatic experiences. Some have lost their children, husbands, and other family members. Others have been victims of sexual harassment and, in some cases, even rape. It's difficult for anyone to heal from such events, but in hopes for a better future, some Rohingya women in the camp are learning meditation in order for them to recover. VOA's Moazem Sakil recently visited one of these sessions and filed this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Mental health experts say meditation can help reduce stress, and that's exactly why these Rohingya refugee women are here. Having gone through severe and traumatic experiences, they're ready to move on.
On the way here from Myanmar, I experienced a lot of hardships. I had body aches everywhere, but after some mental exercise here, I feel better.
In addition to physical exercise and yoga-like meditation, the women also participate in other activities, like talking about their traumas and using art therapy to try to process their experiences.
This is my house. This is me. This is my child. Myanmar's army forces came and attacked us like this.
We have them use these meditations and exercises to overcome their depression. Here they do breathing exercises, partner exercises, and so on. The breathing exercise is very effective.
One Rohingya girl told VOA that her entire family had died. She's the only one left, and this meditation group is the closest thing to a family to her.
There's not one relative on earth, so I feel more uneasy. I've also had to go through many illnesses. I feel very happy for anyone to feel close to me.
Human rights activist Razia Sultana, who recently received the United States International Women of Courage Award for her work with Rohingya refugees, emphasizes the importance of mental support.
These women need mental support. They have become victims of a situation. Everyone has to sympathize with them. Many things have been given, but mental support is much more needed. Mental support will give them confidence.
The project is organized by a non-government organization called Nauzwan, which means young hero in Bengali. The organization works to bring sustainable change in needed areas. For Muazzam Shakil in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, the Chinese Aviation Authority, Indonesian Airlines, and others have grounded Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes indefinitely after two deadly crashes since it began service in 2017. All 157 people on board an Ethiopian Airlines flight were killed Sunday. In October, all 189 people on a Lion Air flight perished in the Java Sea. Stay up to date online at VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. A newly released documentary is giving voice to women who have survived civil war in Myanmar. The women are speaking out to show the devastation of war in hopes of achieving peace. VOA Burmese reporter Saw Tet filed this report from Burma. Ai Tan Sin narrates.
Women have paid a heavy price during the civil war in Myanmar. A new documentary commissioned by the Women's League of Burma exposes just how much women have suffered. And while the documentary may be hard to watch, in some ways, that's the point.
Civil war turns women and children into hostages. Women survivors in this documentary express their desire to have normalcy, livelihood without skirmishes. In order to achieve sustainable peace, there must be ending of fighting among arms group in the country.
The documentary is called Urge, Voices of Women Survivors from Civil War. It features seven women from several different states, including women who live in refugee camps along the Thai-Burma border.
There are mothers who lost children, and there are women who lost husbands from both sides. They all have emotions. For example, wherever they may be, whether in mainland or remote ethnic areas, military wives who also live in mainland also suffer the bitterness of conflicts in ethnic areas. Women are vulnerable and hurt, no matter where they live. This is why we would like to highlight the viral role of women in conflict resolution.
And that's why the Women's League of Burma, which consists of 13 advocacy groups, including 11 ethnic organizations inside Burma, is demanding a ceasefire with the hope of putting an end to the pain and suffering showcased in the documentary. Yi Dan Sin, VOA News, Burma.
Coming up, endangered species are being pushed to the brink. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, an Indonesian woman held in Malaysia since 2017 on suspicions of assassinating the North Korean leader's half-brother, was released from detention Monday. The Shah Alam High Court outside Kuala Lumpur discharged Siti Asia without an acquittal after Malaysian prosecutors withdrew the murder charge. Make your deliberations on top stories at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a recent study of the illegal wildlife trade shows that trafficking in endangered species is increasing in volume and value, and that's further fueling the global extinction crisis. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us more about the report, which shows that Hong Kong is increasingly becoming a center of that trade.
These black-spotted turtles are being kept at an animal rescue center on the outskirts of Hong Kong.
They were smuggled into this region as part of what a new study says is a growing illegal wildlife trade operating out of Hong Kong.
In the last 20 years, the trade has become much more global. We were seeing a lot of animals from Southeast Asia coming through the rescue center, but now we see them from everywhere, from the Philippines, from Mexico, from the United States. The trade is clearly very global.
Gary Aides works at the Kadoorie farm. He says he sees proof that backs up the study, conducted by the Hong Kong Wildlife Trade Working Group.
A lot of these animals are probably passing through Hong Kong. Some of them may be staying here, but actually Hong Kong is like a doorway to southern China and to other parts of Southeast Asia.
A lot of the contraband is what you're used to reading about. Elephants for their ivory tusks and rhino horns for their use in traditional medicine, as well as the scales of the armored pangolin. The study's authors say their report backs this up and aims to prove the problem is serious and growing.
So largely in the databases were pangolin, ivory, woodlogs, and then another category, which is sort of other species. So we wanted to make sure that this was represented in a database that the Hong Kong government could then access and see that this was organized and serious crime.
The Hong Kong government insists they are aggressively fighting smuggling, but the report's authors want to increase the criminal and financial penalties for not only smugglers, but the people behind the market.
That would mean that they would be able to freeze the assets of wildlife traffickers, that they would be able to forfeit those assets, and that they would be able to ensure that the persons behind the large syndicates that operate through Asia and onto other parts of the world are hurt in a way that would make an impact on their businesses.
According to the report, the number of endangered species being trafficked into Hong Kong has increased by 57% over the past decade, and the value of that trade has increased by over 1,600%. But some progress is being made. Last year, after China outlawed the sale of ivory, Hong Kong's legislature enacted a complete ban on their ivory trade. The ban is set to go into effect by 2021. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. A Tokyo District Court has blocked ex-Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn from attending the company's board meeting this week, just days after he was released on bail. Ghosn faces charges of underreporting his salary at Nissan by about $82 million over nearly a decade, charges he has called meritless. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, the HPV virus is so common that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says nearly all sexually active men and women get it at some point in their lives, unless they're protected by vaccination. The HPV virus can lead to cancer in both men and women, and that's why it's so important for parents to get their children vaccinated against this virus. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Anytime you can fish is a good time.
Fishing is Scott Ward's way of relaxing. He didn't have any risk factors that he knew of for cancer, so he ignored the lump on his neck until he couldn't ignore it anymore. Dr. Donald Dahl, an oncologist at the University of Missouri Cancer Center, treated Ward for his cancer.
We're seeing more and more younger, healthier patients. They're not smokers or drinkers. It's HPV related.
Smoking and drinking can cause oral cancers. But Ward's cancer was caused by HPV, the human papillomavirus.
Normally you think HPV, you think of women, cervical cancer.
HPV does cause cervical cancer, but Dr. Dahl says it's a misconception that only women have to be concerned with cancers caused by this virus.
The big ones are the cervical cancer, and the other ones the oropharyngeal cancer.
Oropharyngeal cancers affect the head and neck, including tonsils. Ward's cancer started in a tonsil. HPV can also lead to anal cancer in both sexes and penile cancer in men. But there's a vaccine that's been around for more than a decade that can protect against the HPV virus. If all boys and girls received it, no one would get HPV-related cancers. The HPV vaccine is best when given to children between 9 and 12 years old, before they're sexually active. But teenagers and young adults can still benefit from the vaccine. Not everyone who gets the HPV virus develops cancer, but it is a risk factor. The U.S. Center for Disease Control estimates that 70% of cases of head and neck cancers are caused by HPV. The agency says about 14 million people in the U.S. alone become infected with HPV each year. Yet about half of all U.S. adolescents have not been fully vaccinated against HPV, which requires a series of 3 shots. The CDC says the side effects are generally short-term and not serious. They can include dizziness, headache, nausea, fever, and pain, and swelling in the arm where the shot was given. Ward's recovery was difficult. He had surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, but he's now cancer-free.
It's a journey. I made it through.
Ward wishes the HPV vaccine existed when he was a teen. He says if he had kids, he would get them vaccinated.
It's a prevention. Get it.
Head and neck cancers are the 6th most common cancers worldwide. The HPV virus also causes about 500,000 cases of cervical cancer each year. HPV-related cancers are cancers no one needs to get. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
In a technology that's been heralded as a breakthrough in conservation, remote recording devices are eavesdropping on one of the rarest birds in New Zealand. That's to monitor how they're adjusting after being released into a protective reserve. Faith Lapidus has been listening to the details as we now hear from her.
New Zealand is home to a host of amazing birds, from pigeons to penguins and everything in between. One of the rarest is the stitchbird, also known as hihi. Once found throughout the country's North Island, there are just a few thousand adults left in highly protected reserves. New Zealand conservationists worked with the Zoological Society of London to release 40 juvenile hihi into the Rotokare Reserve about 2 years ago, the first time the species has been seen in that area since 1889. Oliver Metcalf, who was part of the team, says they used high technology to measure the program's success.
What we've done is we've put autonomous acoustic recorders all the way around the reserve so we can monitor how these birds behave when we're not there by listening for their calls, identifying which areas the birds are calling from the most, and if that is changing across time.
The calls, which sound like marbles knocking together, changed from an initial random distribution to a more settled home range.
Settled down into areas that they really prefer being in, which are areas that are close to water, which is a really good indication that hihis are happy with their new site.
With over a terabyte of audio data from those recorders, the researchers needed to develop an algorithm to isolate the hihi calls from those of other birds.
It's really quite distinctive in its way, but there's also, when you turn it into a spectrogram, so that's when you turn sound into an image for the algorithm to work on, it suddenly starts to look like twigs breaking, or there's another bird called the fern bird that's got a similar sort of call, but at a lower frequency, a lower pitch. So then it becomes quite a challenge for the artificial intelligence to recognize it. So we did a lot of work on trying to create an algorithm that was good enough for the artificial intelligence to give us the data we needed.
Metcalf says he hopes his new technique can help track the reintroduction of other species, especially in rugged, remote areas.
This is a brilliant alternative to having people there when it's really difficult terrain to be in. So you can get very similar, very accurate information as if you were having people following them around or as if you were radio tracking the species, but without that intrusiveness for the birds.
Thanks to reintroduction efforts, there are now 7 populations of hihi across their former range in northern New Zealand. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on great radio stations around Asia, like Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. And if you happen to see the Faculty of Communication who run the radio station, tell them thanks. They're doing a great job. Also doing a great job for us is Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Nashwan Kali, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We wish you a great day ahead.